only improve to the point of scientists having the clear ability to decode and visualize dreams. We can now begin to learn more about the construction of dreams, and that knowledge may help disorders of the mind in which dreams are deeply problematic, such as trauma nightmares in PTSD patients. As an individual, rather than a scientist, I must admit to having some vague unease with the idea. Once, our dreams were our own. We got to decide whether or not to share them with others, and if we did, which parts to include and which parts to withhold. Participants in these studies always give their consent. But will the method someday reach beyond science and into the philosophical and ethical realm? There may well be a time in the not-too-distant future where we can accurately read out and thus take ownership of a process that few people have volitional control over, the dream. Footnote. I say few, since there are some individuals who can not only become aware that they are dreaming, but even control how and what they dream. It is called lucid dreaming, and we shall hear much more about it in a later chapter. When this finally happens, and I'm sure it will, do we hold the dreamer responsible for what they dream, or is it fair to judge what it is they are dreaming, since they were not the conscious architect of their dream? But if they were not, then who is? It is a perplexing and uncomfortable issue to face. The meaning and content of dreams. MRI studies helped scientists better understand the nature of dreaming and allowed low-level decoding of dreams. Results of these brain scanning experiments have also led to a prediction about one of the oldest questions in all of humanity, and certainly of sleep. Where do dreams come from? Before the new science of dreaming, and before Freud's unsystematic treatment of the topic, dreams came from all manner of sources. The ancient Egyptians believed dreams were sent down from the gods on high. The Greeks shared a similar contention, regarding dreams as visitations from the gods, offering information divine. Aristotle, however, was a notable exception in this regard. Three of the seven topics in his Parva Naturalia, short treatises on nature, addressed the state of slumber, de somno e vigilia, on sleep, de insomnis, on dreams, and de divinatione per somnum, on divination in sleep. Level-headed as always, Aristotle dismissed the idea of dreams as being heavenly directed, and instead he cleaved strongly to the more self-experienced belief that dreams have their origins in recent waking events. But it was actually Freud who, in my opinion, made the most remarkable scientific contribution to the field of dream research, one that I feel modern-day neuroscience does not give him sufficient credit for. In his seminal book, The Interpretation of Dreams, 1899, Freud situated the dream unquestionably within the brain, that is, the mind, as there is arguably no ontological difference between the two, of an individual. That may seem obvious now, even inconsequential, but at the time it was anything but, especially considering the aforementioned past. Freud had single-handedly wrested dreams from the ownership of celestial beings, and from the anatomically unclear location of the soul. In doing so, Freud made dreams a clear domain of what would become neuroscience, that is, the terra firma of the brain. True and inspired was his proposal that dreams emerge from the brain, as it implied that answers could only be found by way of a systematic interrogation of the brain. We must thank Freud for his paradigmatic shift in thinking. Yet Freud was 50% right and 100% wrong. Things quickly went downhill from this point, as the theory plunged into a quagmire of unprovability. Simply put, Freud believed that dreams came from unconscious wishes that had not been fulfilled. According to his theory, repressed desires, which he termed the latent content, were so powerful and shocking that if they appeared in the dream undisguised, they would wake the dreamer up. To protect the dreamer and his sleep, Freud believed there was a sensor, or a filter, within the mind. Repressed wishes would pass through the sensor and emerge disguised on the other side, the camouflaged wishes and desires, which Freud described as the manifest content, would therefore be unrecognizable to the dreamer, carrying no risk of jolting the sleeping individual awake. Freud believed that he understood how the sensor worked, and that, as a result, he could decrypt the disguised dream, manifest content, and reverse engineer it to reveal the true meaning, latent content, rather like email encryption, wherein the message is cloaked with a code. Without the decryption key, the content of the email cannot be read. Freud felt that he had discovered the decryption key to everyone's dreams, and for many of his affluent Viennese patients, he offered the paid service of removing this disguise and revealing to them the original message content of their dreams. The problem, however, was the lack of any clear predictions from Freud's theory. Scientists could not design an experiment that would test any tenets of his theory in order to help support or falsify it. It was Freud's genius, and his simultaneous downfall. Science could never prove him wrong, which is why Freud continues to cast a long shadow on dream research to this day. But by the very same token, we could never prove the theory right. A theory that cannot be discerned true or false in this way will always be abandoned by science. And that is precisely what happened to Freud and his psychoanalytic practices. As a concrete example, consider the scientific method of carbon dating, used to determine the age of an organic object like a fossil. To validate the method, scientists would have the same fossil analyzed by several different carbon dating machines that operated on the same underlying principle. If the method was scientifically robust, these independent machines should all return the same value of the fossil's age. If they do not, the method must be flawed, as the data is inaccurate and cannot be replicated. The method of carbon dating was shown by this process to be legitimate. Not so for the Freudian psychoanalytic method of dream interpretation. Researchers have had different Freudian psychoanalysts interpret the same dream of an individual. If the method was scientifically reliable, with clear structured rules and metrics that the therapists could apply, then their respective interpretations of this dream should be the same, or at least have some degree of similarity in the extracted meaning they return. Instead, the psychoanalysts all gave remarkably different interpretations of this same dream, without any statistically significant similarity between them. There was no consistency. You cannot place a QC, quality control, sticker on Freudian psychoanalysis. A cynical criticism of the Freudian psychoanalytic method is therefore one of the disease of genericness. Rather like horoscopes, the interpretations offered are generalizable, seemingly providing an explanatory fit to any and all things. For example, before describing the criticisms of Freudian theory in my university lectures, I often do the following with my students as a, perhaps cruel, demonstration. I start by asking anyone in the lecture auditorium if they would be willing to share a dream that I will interpret pro bono on the spot. A few hands will go up. I point to one of the respondents and ask them their name. Let's call this one Kyle. I ask Kyle to tell me his dream. He says, "I was running through an underground parking lot trying to find my car. I don't know why I was running, but I felt like I really needed to get to my car. I found the car, but it wasn't actually the car I owned, but I thought it was my car in the dream. I tried to start the car, but each time I turned the key, nothing happened. Then my cell phone went off loudly and I woke up." In response, I look intensely and knowingly at Kyle, having been nodding my head throughout his description. I pause and then say, "I know exactly what your dream is about, Kyle." Amazed, he and the rest of the lecture hall awaits my answer as though time has ground to a halt. After another long pause, I confidently enunciate the following. "Your dream, Kyle, is about time, and more specifically, about not having enough time to do the things you really want to do in life." A wave of recognition, almost relief, washes over Kyle's face, and the rest of the class appear equally convinced. Then I come clean. Kyle, I have a confession. No matter what dream anyone ever tells me, I always give them that very same generic response, and it always seems to fit. Thankfully, Kyle is a good sport and takes this with no ill grace, laughing with the rest of the class. I apologize once again to him. The exercise, however, importantly reveals the dangers of generic interpretations that feel very personal and uniquely individual, yet scientifically hold no specificity whatsoever. I want to be clear, as this all seems dismissive. I am in no way suggesting that reviewing your dreams yourself, or sharing them with someone else, is a waste of time. On the contrary, I think it is a very helpful thing to do, as dreams do have a function, as we will hear about in the next chapter. Indeed, journaling your waking thoughts, feelings, and concerns has a proven mental health benefit, and the same appears true of your dreams. A meaningful, psychologically healthy life is an examined one, as Socrates so often declared. Nevertheless, the psychoanalytic method built on Freudian theory is non-scientific and holds no repeatable, reliable, or systematic power for decoding dreams. This people must be aware of. In actual fact, Freud knew of this limitation. He had the prophetic sensibility to recognize that a day of scientific reckoning would come. The sentiment is neatly encapsulated in his own words when discussing the origin of dreams in The Interpretation of Dreams, where he states, "Deeper research will one day trace the path further and discover an organic basis for the mental event." He knew that an organic, brain explanation would ultimately reveal the truth of dreams, a truth that his theory lacked. Indeed, 4 years before he descended into a non-scientific, psychoanalytic theory of dreaming in 1895, Freud initially tried to construct a scientifically informed, neurobiological explanation of the mind in a work called The Project for a Scientific Psychology. In it are beautiful drawings of neural circuits with connecting synapses that Freud mapped out, trying to understand the workings of the mind while awake and asleep. Unfortunately, the field of neuroscience was still in its infancy at the time. Science was simply not up to the task of deconstructing dreams, and so unscientific postulates such as Freud's were inevitable. We should not blame him for that, but we should also not accept an unscientific explanation of dreams because of that. Brain scanning methods have offered the first inklings of just this organic truth about the source of dreams. Since autobiographical memory regions of the brain, including the hippocampus, are so active during REM sleep, we should expect dreaming to contain elements of the individual's recent experience and perhaps give clues as to the meaning, if any, of dreams. Something that Freud elegantly described as day residue. It was a clear-cut, testable prediction, which my longtime friend and colleague, Robert Stickgold at Harvard University, elegantly proved was, in fact, utterly untrue. With an important caveat, Stickgold designed an experiment that would determine the extent to which dreams were a precise replay of our recent waking autobiographical experiences. For 2 weeks straight, he had 29 healthy young adults keep a detailed log of daytime activities, the events they were engaged in, going to work, meeting specific friends, meals they ate, sports they played, etc., and their current emotional concerns. In addition, he had them keep dream journals, asking them to write down any recalled dreams that they had when they woke up each morning. He then had external judges systematically compare the reports of the participants' waking activities with their dream reports, focusing on the degree of similarity of well-defined features, such as locations, actions, objects, characters, themes, and emotions. Of a total of 299 dream reports that Stickgold collected from these individuals across the 14 days, a clear rerun of prior waking life events, day residue, was found in just 1-2%. Dreams are not, therefore, a wholesale replay of our waking lives. We do not simply rewind the video of the day's recorded experience and relive it at night, projected on the big screen of our cortex. If there is such a thing as day residue, there are but a few drops of the stuff in our otherwise arid dreams. But Stickgold did find a strong and predictive daytime signal in the static of nighttime dream reports. Emotions. Between 35% and 55% of emotional themes and concerns that participants were having while they were awake during the day, powerfully and unambiguously resurfaced in the dreams they were having at night. The commonalities were just as clear to the participants themselves, who gave similarly confident judgments when asked to compare their own dream reports with their waking reports. If there is a red thread narrative that runs from our waking lives into our dreaming lives, it is that of emotional concerns. Counter to Freudian assumptions, Stickgold had shown that there is no censor, no veil, no disguise. Dream sources are transparent, clear enough for anyone to identify and recognize without the need for an interpreter. Do dreams have a function? Through a combination of brain activity measures and rigorous experimental testing, we have finally begun to develop a scientific understanding of human dreams, their form, content, and the waking sources. There is, however, something missing here. None of the studies that I have described so far proves that dreams have any function. REM sleep, from which principal dreams emerge, certainly has many functions, as we have discussed and will continue to discuss. But do dreams themselves, above and beyond REM sleep, actually do anything for us? As a matter of scientific fact, yes, they do. Chapter 10. Dreaming as Overnight Therapy. It was long thought that dreams were simply epiphenomena of the stage of sleep, REM, from which they emerge. To illustrate the concept of epiphenomena, let's consider the light bulb. The reason we construct the physical elements of a light bulb, the glass sphere, the coiled wire element that sits inside, the screw-in electrical contact at the base, is to create light. That is the function of the light bulb, and the reason we designed the apparatus to begin with. However, a light bulb also produces heat. Heat is not the function of the light bulb, nor is it the reason we originally fashioned it. Instead, heat is simply what happens when light is generated in this way. It is an unintended byproduct of the operation, not the true function. Heat is an epiphenomenon in this case. Similarly, evolution may have gone to great lengths to construct the neural circuits in the brain that produce REM sleep and the functions that REM sleep supports. However, when the human brain produces REM sleep in this specific way, it may also produce this thing we call dreaming. Dreams, like heat from a light bulb, may serve no function. Dreams may simply be epiphenomena of no use or consequence. They are merely an unintended byproduct of REM sleep. Rather a depressing thought, isn't it? I'm sure many of us feel that our dreams have meaning and some useful purpose. To address this stalemate, exploring whether dreaming, beyond the stage of sleep it emerges from, has true purpose, scientists began by defining the functions of REM sleep. Once those functions were known, we could then examine whether the dreams that accompany REM sleep and the very specific content of those dreams were crucial determinants of those adaptive benefits. If what you dream about offers no predictive power in determining the benefits of that REM sleep, it would suggest that dreams are epiphenomenal, and REM sleep alone is sufficient. If, however, you need both REM sleep and to be dreaming about specific things to accomplish such functions, it would suggest that REM sleep alone, although necessary, is not sufficient. Rather, a unique combination of REM sleep plus dreaming, and dreaming of very particular experiences, is needed to transact these nighttime benefits. If this was proven, dreams could not be dismissed as an epiphenomenal byproduct of REM sleep. Rather, science would have to recognize dreaming as an essential part of sleep and the adaptive advantages it supports above and beyond REM sleep itself. Using this framework, we have found two core benefits of REM sleep, Both functional benefits require not just that you have REM sleep, but that you dream, and dream about specific things. REM sleep is necessary, but REM sleep alone is not sufficient. Dreams are not the heat of a light bulb. They are no byproduct. The first function involves nursing our emotional and mental health, and is the focus of this chapter. The second is problem-solving and creativity, the power of which some individuals try to harness more fully by controlling their dreams, which we treat in the next chapter. Dreaming, the soothing balm. It is said that time heals all wounds. Several years ago, I decided to scientifically test this age-old wisdom, as I wondered whether an amendment was in order. Perhaps it was not time that heals all wounds, but rather time spent in dream sleep. I had been developing a theory based on the combined patterns of brain activity and brain neurochemistry of REM sleep, and from this theory came a specific prediction. REM sleep dreaming offers a form of overnight therapy. That is, REM sleep dreaming takes the painful sting out of difficult, even traumatic, emotional episodes you have experienced during the day, offering emotional resolution when you awake the next morning. At the heart of the theory was an astonishing change in the chemical cocktail of your brain that takes place during REM sleep. Concentrations of a key stress-related chemical called noradrenaline are completely shut off within your brain when you enter this dreaming sleep state. In fact, REM sleep is the only time during the 24-hour period when your brain is completely devoid of this anxiety-triggering molecule. Noradrenaline, also known as norepinephrine, is the brain equivalent to a body chemical you already know and have felt the effects of. Adrenaline, epinephrine. Previous MRI studies established that key emotion and memory-related structures of the brain are all reactivated during REM sleep as we dream. The amygdala and emotion-related regions of the cortex and the key mnemonic center, the hippocampus. Not only did this suggest the possibility that emotion-specific memory processing was possible, if not probable, during the dreaming state, but now we understood that this emotional memory reactivation was occurring in a brain free of a key stress chemical. I therefore wondered whether the brain, during REM sleep, was reprocessing upsetting memory experiences and themes in this neurochemically calm, low noradrenaline, safe dreaming brain environment. Is the REM sleep dreaming state a perfectly designed nocturnal soothing balm, one that removes the emotional sharp edges of our daily lives? It seemed so from everything neurobiology and neurophysiology was telling us, me. If so, we should awake feeling better after distressing events of the day, days prior. This was the theory of overnight therapy. It postulated that the process of REM sleep dreaming accomplishes two critical goals. One, sleeping to remember the details of those valuable, salient experiences, integrating them with existing knowledge and putting them into autobiographical perspective. Yet, two, sleeping to forget or dissolve the visceral, painful emotional charge that had previously been wrapped around those memories. If true, it would suggest that the dream state supports a form of introspective life review to therapeutic ends. Think back to your childhood and try to recall some of the strongest memories you have. What you will notice is that almost all of them will be memories of an emotional nature. Perhaps a particularly frightening experience of being separated from your parents or almost being hit by a car on the street. Also notice, however, that your recall of these detailed memories is no longer accompanied by the same degree of emotion that was present at the time of the experience. You have not forgotten the memory, but you have cast off the emotional charge, or at least a significant amount of it. You can accurately relive the memory, but you do not regurgitate the same visceral reaction that was present and imprinted at the time of the episode. Footnote. An exception is the condition of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which we will discuss later in this chapter. The theory argued that we have REM sleep dreaming to thank for this palliative dissolving of emotion from experience. Through its therapeutic work at night, REM sleep performed the elegant trick of divorcing the bitter emotional rind from the information-rich fruit. We can therefore learn and usefully recall salient life events without being crippled by the emotional baggage that those painful experiences originally carried. Indeed, I argued that if REM sleep did not perform this operation, we'd all be left with a state of chronic anxiety in our autobiographical memory networks. Every time we recalled something salient, not only would we recall the details of the memory, but we would relive the same stressful emotional charge all over again. Based on its unique brain activity and neurochemical composition, the dream stage of REM sleep helps us avoid this circumstance. That was the theory. Those were the predictions. Next came the experimental test, the results of which would take a first step toward falsifying or supporting both. We recruited a collection of healthy young adults and randomly assigned them to two groups. Each group viewed a set of emotional images while inside an MRI scanner as we measured their emotional brain reactivity. Then, 12 hours later, the participants were placed back inside the MRI scanner, and we again presented those same emotional images, cueing their recollection while again measuring emotional brain reactivity. During these two exposure sessions, separated by 12 hours, participants also rated how emotional they felt in response to each image. Importantly, however, half of the participants viewed the images in the morning and again in the evening, being awake between the two viewings. The other half of the participants viewed the images in the evening and again the next morning after a full night of sleep. In this way, we could measure what their brains were objectively telling us using the MRI scanners, and, in addition, what participants themselves were subjectively feeling about the relived experiences, having had a night of sleep in between or not. Those who slept in between the two sessions reported a significant decrease in how emotional they were feeling in response to seeing those images again. In addition, results of the MRI scans showed a large and significant reduction in reactivity in the amygdala, that emotional center of the brain that creates painful feelings. Moreover, there was a re-engagement of the rational prefrontal cortex of the brain after sleep that was helping maintain a dampening brake influence on emotional reactions. In contrast, those who remained awake across the day without the chance to sleep and digest those experiences showed no such dissolving of emotional reactivity over time. Their deep emotional brain reactions were just as strong and negative, if not more so, at the second viewing compared with the first, and they reported a similarly powerful re-experiencing of painful feelings to boot. Since we had recorded the sleep of each participant during the intervening night between the two test sessions, we could answer a follow-up question. Is there something about the type or quality of sleep that an individual experiences that predicts how successful sleep is at accomplishing next-day emotional resolution? As the theory predicted, it was the dreaming state of REM sleep and specific patterns of electrical activity that reflected the drop in stress-related brain chemistry during the dream state that determined the success of overnight therapy from one individual to the next. It was not, therefore, time per se that healed all wounds, but instead it was time spent in dream sleep that was providing emotional convalescence. To sleep, perchance to heal. Sleep, and specifically REM sleep, was clearly needed in order for us to heal emotional wounds. But was the act of dreaming during REM sleep, and even dreaming of those emotional events themselves, necessary to achieve resolution and keep our minds safe from the clutches of anxiety and reactive depression? This was the question that Dr. Rosalind Cartwright at Rush University in Chicago elegantly dismantled in a collection of work with her clinical patients. Cartwright, who I contend is as much a pioneer in dream research as Sigmund Freud, decided to study the dream content of people who were showing signs of depression as a consequence of incredibly difficult emotional experiences, such as devastating breakups and bitter divorces. Right around the time of the emotional trauma, she started collecting their nightly dream reports and sifted through them, hunting for clear signs of the same emotional themes emerging in their dream lives relative to their waking lives. Cartwright then performed follow-up assessments up to 1 year later, determining whether the patient's depression and anxiety caused by the emotional trauma were resolved or continued to persist. In a series of publications that I still revisit with admiration to this day, Cartwright demonstrated that it was only those patients who were expressly dreaming about the painful experiences around the time of the events who went on to gain clinical resolution from their despair, mentally recovering a year later as clinically determined by having no identifiable depression. Those who were dreaming, but not dreaming of the painful experience itself, could not get past the event, still being dragged down by a strong undercurrent of depression that remained. Cartwright had shown that it was not enough to have REM sleep, or even generic dreaming, when it comes to resolving our emotional past. Her patients required REM sleep with dreaming, but dreaming of a very specific kind. That which expressly involved dreaming about the emotional themes and sentiments of the waking trauma. It was only that content-specific form of dreaming that was able to accomplish clinical remission and offer emotional closure in these patients, allowing them to move forward into a new emotional future and not be enslaved by a traumatic past. Cartwright's data offered further psychological affirmation of our biological overnight therapy theory, but it took a chance meeting at a conference, one inclement Saturday in Seattle, before my own basic research and theory would be translated from bench to bedside, helping to resolve the crippling psychiatric condition of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Patients with PTSD, who are so often war veterans, have a difficult time recovering from horrific trauma experiences. They are frequently plagued by daytime flashbacks of these intrusive memories and suffer reoccurring nightmares. I wondered whether the REM sleep overnight therapy mechanism we had discovered in healthy individuals had broken down in people suffering from PTSD, thereby failing to help them deal with their trauma memories effectively. When a veteran soldier suffers a flashback, triggered by, say, a car backfiring, they can relive the whole visceral traumatic experience again. It suggested to me that the emotion had not been properly stripped away from the traumatic memory during sleep. If you interview PTSD patients in the clinic, they will often tell you that they just cannot get over the experience. In part, they are describing a brain that has not detoxed the emotion from the trauma memory, such that every time the memory is relived, the flashback, so too is the emotion, which has not been effectively removed. Already we knew that the sleep, especially the REM sleep of patients suffering from PTSD, was disrupted. There was also evidence suggesting that PTSD patients had higher than normal levels of noradrenaline released by their nervous system. Building on our overnight therapy theory of REM sleep dreaming and the emerging data that supported it, I wrote a follow-up theory applying the model to PTSD. The theory proposed that a contributing mechanism underlying the PTSD is the excessively high levels of noradrenaline within the brain that blocks the ability of these patients from entering and maintaining normal REM sleep dreaming. As a consequence, their brain at night cannot strip away the emotion from the trauma memory, since the stress chemical environment is too high. Most compelling to me, however, were the repetitive nightmares reported in PTSD patients, a symptom so reliable that it forms part of the list of features required for a diagnosis of the condition. If the brain cannot divorce the emotion from memory across the first night following a trauma experience, the theory suggests that a repeat attempt of emotional memory stripping will occur on the second night, as the strength of the emotional tag associated with the memory remains too high. If the process fails a second time, the same attempt will continue to repeat the next night and the next night, like a broken record. This was precisely what appeared to be happening with the recurring nightmares of the trauma experience in PTSD patients. A testable prediction emerged. If I could lower the levels of noradrenaline in the brains of PTSD patients during sleep, thereby reinstating the right chemical conditions for sleep to do its trauma therapy work, then I should be able to restore healthier quality REM sleep. With that restored REM sleep quality should come an improvement in the clinical symptoms of PTSD, and further, a decrease in the frequency of painful repetitive nightmares. It was a scientific theory in search of clinical evidence. Then came the wonderful stroke of serendipity. Soon after my theoretical paper was published, I met Dr. Murray Raskind, a remarkable physician who worked at a U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs hospital in the Seattle area. We were both presenting our own research findings at a conference in Seattle, and, at the time, we were each unaware of the other's emerging new research data. Raskind, a tall man with kindly eyes, whose disarmingly relaxed, jocular demeanor belies a clinical acumen that is not to be underestimated, is a prominent research figure in both the PTSD and Alzheimer's disease fields. At the conference, Raskind presented recent findings that were perplexing to him. In his PTSD clinic, Raskind had been treating his war veteran patients with a generic drug called prazosin to manage their high blood pressure. While the drug was somewhat effective for lowering blood pressure in the body, Raskind found it had a far more powerful, yet entirely unexpected benefit within the brain. It alleviated the reoccurring nightmares in his PTSD patients. After only a few weeks of treatment, his patients would return to the clinic and, with puzzled amazement, say things like, "Doc, it's the strangest thing. My dreams don't have those flashback nightmares anymore. I feel better, less scared to fall asleep at night." It turns out that the drug prazosin, which Raskind was prescribing simply to lower blood pressure, also has the fortuitous side effect of suppressing noradrenaline in the brain. Raskind had delightfully and inadvertently conducted the experiment I was trying to conceive of myself. He had created precisely the neurochemical condition, a lowering of the abnormally high concentrations of stress-related noradrenaline within the brain during REM sleep that had been absent for so long in these PTSD patients. Prazosin was gradually lowering the harmful high tide of noradrenaline within the brain, giving these patients healthier REM sleep quality. With healthy REM sleep came a reduction in the patient's clinical symptoms and, most critically, a decrease in the frequency of their repetitive nightmares. Raskind and I continued our communications and scientific discussions throughout that conference. He subsequently visited my lab at UC Berkeley in the months that followed, and we talked non-stop throughout the day and into the evening over dinner about my neurobiological model of overnight emotional therapy and how it seemed to perfectly explain his clinical findings with prazosin. These were hairs on the back of your neck standing up conversations, perhaps the most exciting I have ever experienced in my career. The basic scientific theory was no longer in search of clinical confirmation. The two had found each other one sky-leaking day in Seattle. Mutually informed by each other's work, and based on the strength of Raskin's studies, and now several large-scale independent clinical trials, prazosin has become the officially approved drug by the VA for the treatment of repetitive trauma nightmares, and has since received approval by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for the same benefit. Many questions remain to be addressed, including more independent replication of the findings in other types of trauma, such as sexual abuse or violence. It is also not a perfect medication, due to side effects at higher doses, and not every individual responds to the treatment with the same success. But it is a start. We now have a scientifically informed explanation of one function of REM sleep and the dreaming process inherent in it. And from that knowledge, we have taken the first steps toward treating the distressing and disabling clinical condition of PTSD. It may also unlock new treatment avenues regarding sleep and other mental illness, including depression. Dreaming to decode waking experiences. Just when I thought REM sleep had revealed all it could offer to our mental health, a second emotional brain advantage gifted by REM sleep came to light, one that is arguably more survival relevant. Accurately reading expressions and emotions of faces is a prerequisite of being a functional human being, and indeed, a functional higher primate of most kinds. Facial expressions represent one of the most important signals in our environment. They communicate the emotional state and intent of an individual, and, if we interpret them correctly, influence our behavior in return. There are regions of your brain whose job it is to read and decode the value and meaning of emotional signals, especially faces. And it is that very same essential set of brain regions, or network, that REM sleep recalibrates at night. In this different and additional role, we can think of REM sleep like a master piano tuner, one that readjusts the brain's emotional instrumentation at night to pitch-perfect precision, so that when you wake up the next morning, you can discern overt and subtly covert micro-expressions with exactitude. Deprive an individual of their REM sleep dreaming state, and the emotional tuning curve of the brain loses its razor-sharp precision. Like viewing an image through frosted glass, or looking at an out-of-focus picture, a dream-starved brain cannot accurately decode facial expressions, which become distorted. You begin to mistake friends for foes. We made this discovery by doing the following. Participants came into my laboratory and had a full night of sleep. The following morning, we showed them many pictures of a specific individual's face. However, no two pictures were the same. Instead, the facial expression of that one individual varied across the images in a gradient, shifting from friendly, with a slight smile, calming eye aperture, and approachable look, to increasingly stern and threatening, pursed lips, a furrowed brow, and a menacing look in the eyes. Each image of this individual was subtly different from those on either side of it on the emotional gradient, and across tens of pictures, the full range of intent was expressed, from very pro-social, friendly, to strongly antisocial, unfriendly. Participants viewed the faces in a random fashion while we scanned their brains in an MRI machine, and they rated how approachable or threatening the images were. The MRI scans allowed us to measure how their brains were interpreting and accurately passing the threatening facial expressions from the friendly ones after having had a full night of sleep. All the participants repeated the same experiment, but this time we deprived them of sleep, including the critical stage of REM. Half of the participants went through the sleep deprivation session first, followed by the sleep session second, and vice versa. In each session, a different individual was featured in the pictures, so there was no memory or repetition effects. Having had a full night of sleep, which contained REM sleep, participants demonstrated a beautifully precise tuning curve of emotional face recognition, rather like a stretched-out V-shape. When navigating the cornucopia of facial expressions we showed them inside the MRI scanner, their brains had no problem deftly separating one emotion from another across the delicately changing gradient, and the accuracy of their own ratings proved this to be similarly true. It was effortless to disambiguate friendly and approachable signals from those intimating even minor threat as the emotional tide changed toward the foreboding. Confirming the importance of the dream state, the better the quality of REM sleep from one individual to the next across that rested night, the more precise the tuning within the emotional decoding networks of the brain the next day. Through this platinum-grade nocturnal service, better REM sleep quality at night provided superior comprehension of the social world the next day. But when those same participants were deprived of sleep, including the essential influence of REM sleep, they could no longer distinguish one emotion from another with accuracy. The tuning V of the brain had been changed, rudely pulled all the way up from the base and flattened into a horizontal line, as if the brain was in a state of generalized hypersensitivity, without the ability to map gradations of emotional signals from the outside world. Gone was the precise ability to read giveaway clues in another's face. The brain's emotional navigation system had lost its true magnetic north of directionality and sensitivity, a compass that otherwise guides us toward numerous evolutionary advantages. With the absence of such emotional acuity, normally gifted by the retuning skills of REM sleep at night, the sleep-deprived participants slipped into a default of fear bias, believing even gentle or somewhat friendly-looking faces were menacing. The outside world had become a more threatening and aversive place when the brain lacked REM sleep, untruthfully so. Reality and perceived reality were no longer the same in the eyes of the sleepless brain. By removing REM sleep, we had, quite literally, removed participants' level-headed ability to read the social world around them. Now think of occupations that require individuals to be sleep-deprived, such as law enforcement and military personnel, doctors, nurses, and those in the emergency services, not to mention the ultimate caretaking job, new parents. Every one of these roles demands the accurate ability to read the emotions of others in order to make critical, even life-dependent, decisions, such as detecting a true threat that requires the use of weapons, assessing emotional discomfort or anguish that can change a diagnosis, the extent of palliative pain medication prescribed, or deciding when to express compassion or dispense an assertive parenting lesson. Without REM sleep and its ability to reset the brain's emotional compass, those same individuals will be inaccurate in their social and emotional comprehension of the world around them, leading to inappropriate decisions and actions that may have grave consequences. Looking across the lifespan, we have discovered that this REM sleep recalibration service comes into its own just prior to the transition into adolescence. Before that, when children are still under close watch from their parents, and many salient assessments and decisions are made by mum and or dad, REM sleep provides less of a retuning benefit to a child's brain. But come the early teenage years, and the inflection point of parental independence, wherein an adolescent must navigate the socio-emotional world for himself, now we see the young brain feasting on this emotional recalibration benefit of REM sleep. That is not to suggest that REM sleep is unnecessary for children or infants. It very much is, as it supports other functions we have discussed, brain development, and will next discuss, creativity. Rather, it is that this particular function of REM sleep, which takes hold at a particular developmental milestone, allows the burgeoning pre-adult brain to steer itself through the turbulent waters of a complex emotional world with autonomy. We shall return to this topic in the penultimate chapter when we discuss the damage that early school start times are having on our teenagers. Most significant is the issue of sunrise school bus schedules that selectively deprive our teenagers of that early morning slumber, just at the moment in their sleep cycle when their developing brains are about to drink in most of their much-needed REM sleep. We are bankrupting their dreams in so many different ways. Chapter 11. Dream Creativity and Dream Control. Aside from being a stoic sentinel that guards your sanity and emotional well-being, REM sleep and the act of dreaming have another distinct benefit: intelligent information processing that inspires creativity and promotes problem-solving. So much so that some individuals try controlling this normally non-volitional process and direct their own dream experiences while dreaming. Dreaming, the creative incubator. Deep NREM sleep strengthens individual memories, as we now know, but it is REM sleep that offers the masterful and complementary benefit of fusing and blending those elemental ingredients together in abstract and highly novel ways. During the dreaming sleep state, your brain will cogitate vast swathes of acquired knowledge, and then extract overarching rules and commonalities, the gist. Footnote. One example is language learning and the extraction of new grammatical rules. Children exemplify this. They will start using the laws of grammar, for example, conjunctions, tenses, pronouns, etc., long before they understand what these things are. It is during sleep that their brains implicitly extract these rules, based on waking experience, despite the child lacking explicit awareness of the rules. We awake with a revised, mind-wide web that is capable of divining solutions to previously impenetrable problems. In this way, REM sleep dreaming is informational alchemy. From this dreaming process, which I would describe as eidesthesia, have come some of the most revolutionary leaps forward in human progress. There is perhaps no better illustration highlighting the smarts of REM sleep dreaming than the elegant solution to everything we know of and how it fits together. I'm not trying to be obtuse. Rather, I am describing the dream of Dmitri Mendeleev on February 17, 1869, which led to the periodic table of elements, the sublime ordering of all known constituent building blocks of nature. Mendeleev, a Russian chemist of renowned ingenuity, had an obsession. He felt there might be an organizational logic to the known elements in the universe, euphemistically described by some as the search for God's abacus. As proof of his obsession, Mendeleev made his own set of playing cards, with each card representing one of the universal elements and its unique chemical and physical properties. He would sit in his office, at home, or on long train rides, and maniacally deal the shuffled deck down onto a table, one card at a time, trying to deduce the rule of all rules that would explain how this ecumenical jigsaw puzzle fit together. For years he pondered the riddle of nature. For years he failed. After allegedly having not slept for 3 days and three nights, he'd reached a crescendo of frustration with the challenge. While the extent of sleep deprivation seems unlikely, a clear truth was Mendeleev's continued failure to crack the code. Succumbing to exhaustion, and with the elements still swirling in his mind and refusing organized logic, Mendeleev lay down to sleep. As he slept, he dreamed, and his dreaming brain accomplished what his waking brain was incapable of. The dream took hold of the swirling ingredients in his mind, and, in a moment of creative brilliance, snapped them together in a divine grid, with each row, period, and each column, group, having a logical progression of atomic and orbiting electron characteristics, respectively. In Mendeleev's own words, "I saw in a dream a table where all the elements fell into place as required. Awakening, I immediately wrote it down on a piece of paper. Only in one place did a correction later seem necessary." While some contest how complete the dream solution was, no one challenged the evidence that Mendeleev was provided a dream-inspired formulation of the periodic table. It was his dreaming brain, not his waking brain, that was able to perceive an organized arrangement of all known chemical elements. Leave it to REM sleep dreaming to solve the baffling puzzle of how all constituents of the known universe fit together, an inspired revelation of cosmic magnitude. My own field of neuroscience has been the beneficiary of similar dream-fueled revelations. The most impactful is that of neuroscientist Otto Loewi. Loewi dreamed of a clever experiment on two frogs' hearts that would ultimately reveal how nerve cells communicate with each other using chemicals, neurotransmitters, released across tiny gaps that separate them, synapses, rather than direct electrical signaling that could only happen if they were physically touching each other. So profound was this dream-implanted discovery that it won Loewi a Nobel Prize. We also know of precious artistic gifts that have arisen from dreams. Consider Paul McCartney's origination of the songs Yesterday and Let It Be. Both came to McCartney in his sleep. In the case of Yesterday, McCartney recounts the following dream-inspired awakening while he was staying in a small attic room of his family's house on Wimpole Street, London, during the filming of the delightful movie Help. "I woke up with a lovely tune in my head. I thought, that's great. I wonder what that is. There was an upright piano next to me, to the right of the bed by the window. I got out of bed, sat at the piano, found G, found F sharp minor seventh, and that leads you through then to B, to E minor, and finally back to E. It all leads forward logically. I liked the melody a lot, but because I dreamed it, I couldn't believe I'd written it. I thought, no, I've never written anything like this before. But I had, which was the most magic thing." Having been born and raised in Liverpool, I am admittedly biased toward emphasizing the dreaming brilliance of the Beatles. Not to be outdone, however, Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones as arguably the best sleep-inspired story, which gave rise to the opening riff of their song, Satisfaction. Richards would routinely keep a guitar and tape recorder at his bedside to record ideas that would come to him in the night. He describes the following experience on May 7, 1965, after having returned to his hotel room in Clearwater, Florida, following a performance that evening. I go to bed as usual with my guitar, and I wake up the next morning, and I see that the tape is run to the very end, and I think, well, I didn't do anything. Maybe I hit a button when I was asleep. So I put it back to the beginning and pushed play, and there, in some sort of ghostly version, is the opening lines to Satisfaction. It was the whole verse of it, and after that there's 40 minutes of me snoring, but there's the song in its embryo, and I actually dreamt the damn thing. The creative muse of dreaming has also sparked countless literary ideas and epics. Take the author Mary Shelley, who passed through a most frightening dream scene one summer night in 1816, while staying in one of Lord Byron's estates near Lake Geneva, a dream she almost took to be waking reality. That dreamscape gave Shelley the vision and narrative for the spectacular Gothic novel, Frankenstein. Then there is the French surrealist poet, Saint-Paul Boux, who well understood the fertile talents of dreaming. Before retiring each night, he is said to have hung a sign on his bedroom door that read, "Do not disturb, poet at work." Anecdotes such as these are enjoyable stories to tell, but they do not serve as experimental data. What, then, is the scientific evidence establishing that sleep, and specifically REM sleep and dreaming, provides a form of associative memory processing, one that fosters problem-solving? And what is so special about the neurophysiology of REM sleep that would explain these creative benefits and the dreaming obligate to them? REM sleep fuzzy logic. An obvious challenge to testing the brain when it is asleep is that it is asleep. Sleeping individuals cannot engage in computerized tests, nor provide useful responses, the typical way that cognitive scientists assess the workings of the brain. Short of lucid dreaming, which we will address at the end of this chapter, sleep scientists have been left wanting in this regard. We have frequently been resigned to passively observing brain activity during sleep, without ever being able to have participants perform tests while they are sleeping. Rather, we measure waking performance before and after sleep, and determine if the sleep stages or dreaming that occurred in between explains any observed benefit the next day. I and my colleague at Harvard Medical School, Robert Stickgold, designed a solution to this problem, albeit an indirect and imperfect one. In Chapter 7, I describe the phenomenon of sleep inertia, the carryover of the prior sleeping brain state into wakefulness in the minutes after waking up. We wondered whether we could turn this brief window of sleep inertia to our experimental advantage, not by waking subjects up in the morning and testing them, but rather by waking individuals up from different stages of NREM sleep and REM sleep throughout the night. The dramatic alterations in brain activity during NREM and REM sleep, and their tidal shifts in neurochemical concentrations, do not reverse instantaneously when you awaken. Instead, the neural and chemical properties of that particular sleep stage will linger, creating the inertia period that separates true wakefulness from sleep and lasts some minutes. Upon enforced awakening, the brain's neurophysiology starts out far more sleep-like than wake-like, and, with each passing minute, the concentration of the prior sleep stage from which an individual has been woken will gradually fade from the brain as true wakefulness rises to the surface. By restricting the length of whatever cognitive test we performed to just 90 seconds, we felt we could wake individuals up and very quickly test them in this transitional sleep phase. In doing so, we could perhaps capture some of the functional properties of the sleep stage from which the participant was woken, like capturing the vapors of an evaporating substance and analyzing those vapors to draw conclusions about the properties of the substance itself. It worked. We developed an anagram task in which the letters of real words were scrambled. Each word was composed of five letters, and the anagram puzzles only had one correct solution. For example, OSEOG equals goose. Participants would see the scrambled words one at a time on the screen for just a few seconds, and they were asked to